In 1970, a 28-year-old recent law school graduate became the most wanted woman in America.
Angela Davis was replaced on the FBI's 10 most wanted list this afternoon by Bernadine Ray Dorn, described as an underground leader of the Weathermen.
They said she was an enemy of the state.
Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
A homegrown terrorist.
A bomb exploded early this morning in the Pentagon.
J. Edgar Hoover called her the most dangerous woman in America.
I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war.
That is an excerpt from a new podcast called Mother Country Radical, and you're hearing them talk about Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers as if they were heroes. They were terrorists beginning in the 60s through the 80s. They went to prison. They have been now in universities since then, becoming, I would say, intellectual terrorists, spreading communism around the country. Well, our podcast today is not specifically about them, although we will talk about them. It's about next-generation Marxism, next-gen Marxism. What is it and how to combat it? Two experts have just written this book. They're actually longtime friends of mine, friends, professional friends, and they are just brilliant. You're going to learn a lot from this book and from this discussion, so I hope you'll stay tuned. You know you're listening to Sandy Rios, I hope, on Sandy Rios 24/7. You can call us at 662-821-2040. You can go to sandyrios.com to listen to the podcast or to any podcast platform, and especially to AFR.net, which is American Family Radio. That's our home base. You can write me at sandy@AFR.net. And so all of those things will help us be a team here as we try to get the word out on all of these important things, topics that I'm talking about in these dangerous days that we're living. Let me tell you a story. There was a girl named Katrina, and she had a dream that she was pregnant with a baby boy. And she heard a voice that said, Eli. But many around her were pressuring her to get an abortion. By God's grace, she was led to preborn network clinics where she was given a free ultrasound. And when she saw her baby on the sonogram, she was amazed to see that her baby had a halo. And then she heard his heartbeat. At that moment, she had no doubt there was a miracle growing inside her womb. Oh, that's Katrina's story. It's a beautiful story, and a life was changed by the work of preborn. And that life was changed by the generous giving of many of you who listen to Sandy Rios 24/7. If you'd like to help, it's $28 per ultrasound. $28, that's all. Just one baby's life saved, $28. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. All right, today's a biggie, and we're going to be having some deep discussions about how Marxism is manifesting itself in our country right now. The book is called Next Gen Marxism. Stay tuned for the discussion on Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something.
I also think that it might... I think of a lot of things. The first thing I think is that we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia in particular are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on sort of ideological theories. And I think that what we really try to do is build a movement that could be utilized by many, many Black folk.
Sandy Rios with you. That's the voice of Patrice Cullors. She is a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. That's not a new clip. We've played it before. But it's really very clear that Black Lives Matter is Marxist-based. But they're not the only group right now that are Marxist-based. We are seeing so much of Marxism around us, and so that's what we're going to be talking about. Let me just read this. Many Americans believe that the United States is in decline. They see a country that has become unrecognizable, where individuals are reduced to their race, ethnicity, or sexual identity, where children are indoctrinated into radical ideologies, where anti-Semitism has become widespread. But the Marxism of today is not the Marxism of the old Europe. It has been adapted and refined by America's student radicals of the 1960s and diffused throughout the culture as those student radicals became professors, community organizers, and leaders. And that's kind of a tease about what we're going to be talking about today. Two of my favorite authors, two of my favorite scholars and intellectuals of all time are joining me today because they've written a book together called Next Gen Marxism. What is it and how to combat it? Mike Gonzalez is the Angelus T. Avedondo Senior Fellow on E Pluribus Unum at the Heritage Foundation. And Mike, it's so great to have you. Good morning. You're in New York City, I know. And we're always delighted to have you on my show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm about to arrive at my destination. You're indeed right. I'm speaking to a group of students here in New York City. And I'm very happy to join you with my co-author, Catherine Gorka.
Yeah. Mike, let me ask you, before you have to talk to your cabbie, what was your intersection? I know this is not a simple question for you, but your intersection and interest in communism, what in your background led you to want to do that? I didn't actually give, by the way, Mike was a journalist for 20 years, 15 of them writing from Europe, Asia, and Latin America. So, but what piqued your interest in communism?
There's many things, right? I mean, I was born in Cuba to begin with. I left at the age of 12. I have lived, then I became a foreign correspondent for a U.S. newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, and also for the French press agencies. I traveled the world. I saw many different regimes. At the bottom of it, is that I recognize what is happening here, and I want to protect America. I want to protect America and Americans from what is taking place.
Yeah, and my experience in the last, 10 years knowing you, you've written some powerful articles, made some powerful speeches. You've had tremendous impact. So you and Katie have sort of joined together, bringing your expertise to write this book. And Catherine Cornell Gorka formerly served as director for civil society at the Heritage Foundation. And prior to that, she worked as a presidential appointee in the Office of Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. She focused there on strategies for the prevention of terrorism and targeted violence. She was the president of Threat Knowledge Group, providing expertise and training on irregular warfare and terrorism to the FBI, the U.S. Army Special Forces, Marine Corps, and law enforcement. She was also the executive director of the Westminster Institute, which conducted research and education on threats posed by external ideologies. She co-edited the volume Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. And yes, it's Catherine Cornell Gorka. She has a very familiar name because she is the wife of Sebastian. And I have to tell you personally that Sebastian met his match when he married Katie. She is definitely his equal. So it's always a delight, Katie, to have you join me. Thank you.
Oh, Sandy, I love talking with you. So super happy to be here today.
All right. So you have an interesting past, too. And why your expertise and interest in communism?
Yeah, so I was kind of your typical disgruntled American from my youth and from my college experience. You know, I really wasn't a great patriot. I certainly wouldn't have identified as a conservative. But in 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, I was captivated. And I said to myself, I need to go there and see these momentous changes. And that's what really opened my eyes. I then spent the next 18 years, 12 of which I actually lived in Eastern Europe because I met my husband. We lived in Hungary for 12 years. But before that, I'd been living and I'd been sort of going back and forth and working there. And it was really only when I experienced post-communism firsthand, when I saw the way communism just destroys the soul of a nation, that I really came to understand how precious the United States is, and how we really have to do everything in our power to defend what we have. So that's kind of the origin of my interest in the subject.
Let me ask you one more just practical question before we jump into the content. Why did you and Mike collaborate on this? And I know the answer kind of, but what expertise, like the distinction of your expertise, did you bring to the book, both of you?
Yeah, so Mike and I were, so Mike's been at the Heritage Foundation for a long time. I joined after I left the Trump administration. I joined just weeks before the COVID shutdown. And Mike and I shared a lot of this sort of similar interests in Marxism, communism, that kind of thing. And we were, you know, we used to talk a lot as the COVID shutdown was happening. I started traveling around the country working with the nascent parent groups that were trying to regain control over their children's education. Mike was doing just incredibly groundbreaking work on Black Lives Matter. And then, of course, you had the George Floyd protests. So, you know, eventually we looked at each other and said, you know, we need to do more to help Americans understand what we are up against, and we need to develop a strategy to combat it, and we need to put those tools in the hands of Americans. And that was why we decided to collaborate.
All right, so let's go, let's make it real simple. Mike, are you with us, or has the cabbie got your attention?
No. I'm actually at the venue where I'm supposed to speak.
Okay, good.
I'm in a quiet room now upstairs, so I'm good to go.
Okay, good. All right, I want to ask you a simple question, and that is, the title is Next Gen Marxism. Well, what is it? That's the subtitle. What is it? Before we even jump into this, what are you calling Next Gen Marxism?
So Katie and I, and by the way, Katie was just a fantastic person to do a book with. Katie and I went back and forth on what to call this new version of Marxism that we're seeing. It's obviously not the Marxism of Karl Marx, Katie and I can talk into that. It's cultural Marxism, but it's cultural Marxism with some American some American characteristics. So we came up with that term. So what it is the Marxism of Karl Marx as it went through the evolution of the 1920s and 30s, where some elements were added, some elements of Marx were de-emphasized, others kept, and then as it migrated to the United States in the 1960s and then began to be implemented in the universities in the 1980s, it added some unique American elements. And by that, I don't mean jazz or fried chicken. I mean an obsession with sex, an obsession with race, organizing, neighborhood organizing, which, as Katie will say, was really started by Lenin, but then it was American community organizing, something perfected by Saul Alinsky here in the United States, and it's very much present in that. And then you in Next Gen Marxism, and then you have you played the tape of Patrice Couleurs saying she's a Marxist. It's got the vast Marxist networks that span the globe that had an impact on the architects of Black Lives Matter, and then it also had the use of social media to organize street mayhem. So all these things bring us to what is today Next Gen Marxism, and Katie and I can explain how it has an impact on our daily lives.
Yes. Katie, you experienced, of course, in Hungary, you and Sebastian, it was after communism that you lived there. Nevertheless, I don't want to interject my own experiences here, but you probably both might remember I lived in Berlin when the wall was still there, and I've spent time in China and North Korea also, and Russia before the Soviet Union broke up. So I have some taste of this myself. But I'm asking you, Katie, how does this new communism contrast with the old? The old failed, by the way. Maybe I should just ask that. Why did the old system fail? The old, because they wanted to spread. It was like a religion. They wanted the whole world to be communist. They were evangelical about that. Why did they fail?
Well, I think you have to. I think the real question is, why does Marxism always fail? And you know, so let's look a little bit at the history. So in the first 70 years after the Communist Manifesto, Marxism never took hold. Right. Marx predicted that there would be a workers' revolution. The workers would rise up because they were being so exploited by the bourgeoisie, the owners of capital. Right. But that never happened. And in fact, really the opposite happened. You know, as you had sort of industrialization and free markets continue to develop, the workers found themselves doing better and better. Their conditions improved. So they didn't want to overthrow the systems that they lived in. And that's also the failed revolutions that Mike speaks of. You know, a lot of people don't realize, but Italy and Germany came very, very close to having successful communist revolutions. But ultimately, those failed because the workers wanted to keep their work. They wanted to keep their families, their countries, right? They didn't want to overthrow them. But what Mike referred to was, you know, that Lenin came with kind of a magic formula. The thing that Lenin brought to this that hadn't been done before is two key pieces. Well, three, actually. So first is he realized you have to be super, super organized to make this happen, to change people's minds and get them riled up for revolution. The second is you have to really make people feel aggrieved and victimized. And he was very good at that. And the third is you have to have very strong, top-down, dictatorial control to make this work. Those are the only conditions under which Marxism actually works. And yes, it does ultimately fail because people will not live like that for long. They, you know, it took 70 years, to be fair, for them to sort of muster the strength to overthrow it in the Soviet Union. But I think, you know, in other countries, it hasn't taken that long. And, you know, I think we're already seeing that turning point here in the United States, right? People are seeing the, how shall I say, like the totalitarian aspects of this next-gen Marxism, right? The whole cancel culture. Absolutely, that is a part of Marxism, and people are saying, we're not going to have this. This is not American. We reject this. I predict it's going to fail. I know it looks dire right now. I'm, you know, extremely concerned about what's happening still in our universities, but I do predict that this will fail.
One thing that might help, and by the way, both of you feel free to speak up if you want to comment on something I'm asking. But Mike, the manifestations of, let's do this. In 1989, you already mentioned 1989, was when a big change happened. Of course, the Berlin Wall came down, and we thought, everybody boasted and beat their chest that communism was defeated. But you guys say in your book that's not so. Can you make that case?
Yeah, I'm going to let Katie does a really good job of describing 1989, so I'm going to let her take that one. But I want to add a little bit about what you said, that Marxism failed. Katie and I get into this in our book, they do try to communize us. You know, between 1917 and the 1950s, they actually tried to create a push for a second republic here in the United States, one in the South for Black Americans. They use the gaping gash that we have in our of race relations. Don't forget, this is in the middle of Jim Crow, to say to American Blacks, you know, you're being you're an aggrieved group. You really should be asked for separatism and set up a Soviet republic. Well, they didn't say a Soviet, but eventually it would have been a Soviet republic in the South. And American Blacks wanted none of that. American Blacks wanted to be able to join the system, from which they were being kept out of in the South, especially. They didn't want to destroy the system like the workers like Katie described. So that heavy hand. And the Soviet Union stopped. Finally, walked away from this in the 1950s. In fact, we quote it in the book, but definitely I have read it. There's an FBI memo that praises the NAACP for patriotically saying, "No, we don't want any of this Soviet stuff." What is much more threatening is when it comes back in this new phase of next-gen Marxism in which it presents itself under the cloak of social justice. It's led by Americans, Americans like Patrice Couleurs, Americans like Eric Mann, Americans like the professors in universities, Americans like Angela Davis, Americans, you know, in every walk of life, and not just, you know, especially in the cultural institutions, even people who say, well, I'm not a Marxist, but acting out along according to the precepts and the principles of Marxism. So that is much more threatening. However, I do agree with Katie. The only one caveat I would have with Katie is that Katie and I are not just passively waiting for it to fail. We wrote a book and do interviews such as this, and we're working actively, Katie and I, to make sure it does fail.
Yeah. By the way, the book is called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. It's already sold out on Amazon. So it just came out. It's published by Encounter Books. And it's something that I think, given what we're seeing with our children in the universities and our economics, all of it is tied to this Marxist roots. And actually, Katie, let me ask you a different question than I hinted. Can you just give us the hallmarks? Isn't it amazing how people really don't know what communism is? They know in general, and there was a time you might remember a couple of decades ago when we couldn't say the word because we were thought to be foolish. Now the word is dared to be spoken, and they're actually boasting and claiming, you know, their Marxist roots right now, meaning the left. So what are the hallmarks? Can you just give us some signs of communism that people can recognize?
Yeah, I think the most, well, and again, I think I'm going to make a distinction between Marxism and communism. Let me focus a little bit more on Marxism per se. So the really, to me, the singular hallmark of Marxism is that it is a zero-sum view of the world. It is the world divided into oppressor and oppressed. Now, for Marx, that was the worker versus the owners. In our day, as you know, it's changed, right? Now, today, it's sort of white heterosexual Christians or white heterosexuals in general versus, blacks, gays, handicapped, transgender, everybody else, right? They've created these kind of false categories. And it's the idea that we as Americans cannot work together to solve our problems. And that to me is I think the thing that I find so distressing about it, because we know that's not true, right? I think as a country, our founders set a very high ideal. We absolutely did not reach that ideal, you know, for centuries, right? For decades, for centuries. It took us a long time to get rid of slavery. It took us a long time to get rid of Jim Crow. But we have continually sought to reach that ideal. Marxism says we can't reach it. And the only way that you can fix things is if you overthrow one class of people and put the other class in power. It's all about power. Mike, what would you add to that?
No, I think that is perfect. I think one element that is retained in today's Marxism. So what is not retained? The economic determinism, the idea that the revolution has to be led by workers. Katie got into that. The idea that man's social class depends on his relationship to the factors of production. All of this is pushed aside, and the idea that there's always a need for a violent, bloody revolution to bring about communism or Marxism, that is also pushed aside. You can have a revolution be a bloody and violent. It's always better if it's preceded by indoctrination and infiltration. But if it presents itself, if the opportunity presents itself, as they thought it did in 2020, by all means, have at it. But added to that boiling down of all human interaction between the oppressed and the oppressor, which is in the first page of the manifesto, in English translation, maybe Katie is much more erudite than I am, as you can tell already, the listeners can tell. Maybe she's read it in the original German. I've only read it in English. And it's very clear there. In the first page, it says, all of human history comes down to an epic struggle between the oppressed and the oppressor. That is there. Another element that are present in today's Marxism is this, which are also present in the manifesto of 1848, which Marx writes with his sugar daddy, Friedrich Engels, is the call to the soul to abolish the family, the call to abolish the nation state, the call to abolish private property, and the call to abolish God. That God himself does not appear in the manifesto, but Marx writes just prior to the manifesto, just after the manifesto, I forget which, maybe Katie remembers, that religion is the opiate of the people because it gives men hope, and he doesn't want men to have hope. He wants men to be bloody upset and commit bloody acts. So those elements, those four elements, are present today, have survived through the many distillations of Marxism. And you have it, for example, in BLM. And I don't want to always go back to BLM because BLM are just one manifestation of this, right? But BLM had in its 13 principles the abolition of the family until I wrote about it with my colleague at the Heritage Foundation, Andy Olivastro. We wrote about it in the New York Post very early on in July of 2020. And what do you know? BLM, true Marxists that they are, airbrushed this out of their principles. The 13 principles become suddenly 12 principles, and they get rid of the call to abolish the family, the Western-oriented nuclear family. But they're also dumb and heavy-handed because they leave it in other places like BLM. Black Lives Matter Los Angeles still has it up. So those elements are still present today, and they were present in the 1840s.
Absolutely. I mean, they abolish a family, a private property of God, a middle class, a particular target. We can see
and the
all
nation
of these.
State. The nation state as well.
In the nation state, destroying the history of the, that's what they always do. They destroy the history, culture of the nations that they infect. It's like a cancer. I want to play something for you, Katie, and then let you respond to this. This is from Democracy Now, and you will, I hope, talk about how things kind of morphed in the United States and communism later on in the 60s through the 80s. This is clip one. Let's listen.
An activist who replaced Angela Davis on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, Bernadine Dorn, leader of the radical 60s and 70s organization called the Weather Underground. It was 50 years ago this year that they bombed the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. They also battled with police during days of rage on the streets of Chicago and partnered with black liberation groups to rob banks. When Bernadine Dorn and her fellow Weather Underground activist husband Bill Ayers literally went underground to avoid arrest, they then raised a family as they continued to fight for revolution.
There's a new series called Mother Country Radical, in which the son of Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn is the host. And anyway, that's a clip from their opening. But Catherine, please help us understand how communism got its deep roots and when we actually saw it morph into, at least the beginnings of the morphing into what it is now, which you're calling the next gen Marxism.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I just have to say I'm shocked. I shouldn't be, but I'm shocked that they're even doing a series like this. I mean, are they, I'm assuming they're kind of like rehabilitating them and presenting them in a positive light.
Absolutely.
I just want to, yeah, it's, you know, I hope that people will read the book. Mike does an incredible job in writing about, well, okay, we both did. I always say that, but especially Mike on Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. They are just evil incarnate. And you know, there are things that she did that they both did that are so evil. I don't even want to describe them on the radio because they're so disturbing. But yes, this is a key part of why we are where we are today is because of them and people like them. You had these 60s, you know, these students in the 60s who were, you know, basically discontented elites, right, who got radicalized through various factors, embraced Marxism, Many of them went into our inner cities in the 60s, fomented revolution and discontent there, which, you know, let's just mention, had a really devastating impact on the black populations in those inner cities. And then you get to the end of the 60s, and these 60s radical students say to themselves, okay, the revolution has kind of failed. What do we do now? And you see them going in basically three different directions. One group, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers among them, go super radical and say we haven't been radical enough, and they develop the Weather Underground and carry out bombings across the country. So they go terrorist, right? Then you have a group that says, well, we couldn't carry out the revolution through normal means. Let's do it using the law. And they're the ones who went into the universities and developed first critical legal studies, which then gave birth to critical race theory. And then I would say you had a third group that really developed, quote, organizing, right? They understood that you have to organize the people to get them to stand up and rebel. I was just rereading, a great book that Roger Kimball wrote, because there were, you know, one of the arguments Mike and I make in the book is that so many of us were focused on the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, and we thought it would be in China as well in 1989. But in fact, there was a newspaper article in the New York Times that said, no, the Marxists have kind of gone mainstream in American universities. A couple of people did make note of that. One of them was Roger Kimball, who I'm actually proud to say he's our publisher. He's the head of Encounter Books. But he wrote a book right around that time, I want to say 1990, and he quotes a writer and still a professor, I think, at Middlebury named Jay Perini, who wrote at the time, after the Vietnam War, a lot of us didn't just crawl back into our literary cubicles. We stepped into academic positions. With the war over, our visibility was lost, and it seemed for a while that we had disappeared. Now we have tenure, and the work of reshaping the universities has begun in earnest. So that's a big part of why we are where they are. And you know, as you know, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, you know, once they get out of prison, they become celebrated. They go into, you know, they become professors. They win awards for their teaching. They end up shaping a lot of things in education, and it just kind of blows my mind when you think of how evil they were, that this is the position that they are in today. And I think we need to do more to expose it. We need to talk about just how evil they were.
I told Katie, totally agree. I'm from Chicago. Bernadine Dorn has been on staff there. She may still be on staff there at Northwestern, one of the most prestigious schools in the nation, at least it was, and Bill Ayers became a writer of educational textbooks, seeping. In fact, Wheaton College was actually using some of his writing. I took that on a radio in Chicago. But Mike, I know that you are pressed for time because you have to speak. So I want to know what your thoughts are, since this is your expertise also.
Well, you know, Katie is too much of a lady to describe what Bernadine Dorn and her husband Bill Ayers did. I have no such compunction, so I'm going to give you a more graphic description. As you know, in 1969, you had the Charles Manson murders. This happened a very long time ago. Many of the listeners who were born after that may not remember, but they went and they massacred, innocent people in California. One of them was Sharon Tate, who was the wife of Roman Polanski, an American movie director of Polish descent. And she was pregnant, and they killed her as she was begging for her life and the life of her baby. And then they stuck a fork in her belly. And Bernadine Dorn, at a meeting of the Weather Underground, actually celebrated that. She said, "Dig it, man. They killed those pigs and stuck a fork in them." And then she gave a three-finger salute to mimic a fork. And that is in our book. And that is unforgivable. And many people at the time, including Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was a Democrat who worked both sides. He was in the Nixon cabinet. Then he became a senator from New York. A very intelligent man, one of the most intelligent Americans of the 20th century. So this is what. Yes, they were terrorists. I don't like to say former terrorists, because once you have committed acts of terrorism, unless you apologize and you work directly to atone for all the things you did, which is not the case for this couple. Bill Harris has said, "I'm not sorry for what we did. We didn't do enough." That's what he has said. And the fact that he is today called, including by Tom Brokaw in a famous broadcast, he called him an educational reformer. As Sol Stern wrote, that to call Bill Ayers an educational reformer is akin to calling Joseph Stalin an agricultural reformer. No, they entered the field of education because they understood the main message of the book by me and Katie, that you revolutionize America by infiltrating the institutions and indoctrinating the young. And that is why education is the main battleground today. There are many other battlegrounds, but education, by God, is the main platform through which these ideas have entered the bloodstream of our country. And they have. And let me just give you an example. I will go in 5 minutes, but an example of that is the aberrant behavior that we see of students demonstrating supporting terrorists. The terrorist, attack in Israel on October 7th last year, and they're supporting the Hamas terrorists, and they're ignoring the plight of the Jewish women they gang raped on October 7th. And why do they do that? Because they were taught to simplify things and put them in that simple paradigm of oppressor and oppressed that Katie spoke about. And when you have really, really bad outcomes.
I would guess so. A friend of mine this morning, I was sharing that podcast I discovered last night, Mother Country Radical, which I know you guys will want to see that also. I have a picture here that my friend sent took of Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn on Inauguration Day in 2017. And I was there in that day. Maybe you guys, I'm sure you were in D.C. or close by. But there was so much trouble on the streets. That's the day before the pink hats, all of the unrest, the attacks on people at inaugural events. And they're smiling, holding these signs still. So their effect has been profound. Mike, just let us know when you have to take off here. But Catherine, help us to understand. We've said it. We've touched on it. But can you, in a word, tell us what the morphing has been? Prior to their era, American universities were some of the top in the world. Britain might have been ahead of them, but only Britain, as far as I can remember. We had the best school system in the world. What happened? How did communism seep in, and how did it change what was happening in curriculum?
Well, so there were, for as long as socialism has existed as an idea, it has enticed some people, right? Because they don't study history, or they don't know what it's going to lead to. And so, you had various organizations over time trying to introduce socialist ideas on campuses. I mean, that really started as early as the turn of the century, 1900. But there was something special that really happened in the 1950s. And so I would say it was a couple things. I think one is you had major American writers.
I'll leave you in extremely capable hands with the greatest author ever, Catherine Cornell Gorka, Katie Gorka, to me and you. So I'm going to go now.
That's high praise from you, because you're a marvelous author yourself, Mike, and great intellect. And I so appreciate you joining us and giving us your time. So go give it to them there, wherever you're speaking. The book is called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka, otherwise known to me as Katie, are the authors of that book. And it's available right now on Amazon and other places where books are sold.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
I told you earlier today about Katrina and how she had a dream that she was pregnant with a little boy, and how she went to a preborn network clinic, saw him in utero, and decided to not go through an abortion. It's a beautiful story. There are so many like them. If you have the means, I wonder if you would consider a larger gift, more than the $28, if you have the ability to do that. Your tax-deductible donation of $5,000 would sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours, and that would rescue not one, not two, not three, but 200 babies. To donate, all you have to do is go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Hi, this is Sandy Rios, and I miss you in the mornings. But now I'm hosting a podcast, Sandy Rios 24/7, which is available at afr.net and sandyrios.com. Well, I finally finished that book. God's Velvet Hammer chronicles God's call in my life, from a small town girl to Berlin, Germany, Radio Moscow to North Korea to Washington, D.C. I talk about Sasha Girl. That was my disabled daughter. I talk about I've Got the Music in Me. That's a chapter on my music life. Lost in India and Other Adventures is hilarious. You won't want to miss it. I talk about my sweetheart, The Blessing of Bruce. And then a mysterious chapter called My Green Face and the End of It All. Oh, I think you'll enjoy it. Like the Apostle Paul, these are my shipwrecks and my adventures. All for Christ and His kingdom. God's Velvet Hammer is available wherever books are sold. And remember, Sandy Rios 24/7 is available at afr.net and sandyrios.com.
Hello, this is Bernadine Dorn. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. All over the world, people fighting American imperialism look to America's youth to use our strategic position behind enemy lines to join forces in the destruction of the empire. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives.
That was Bernadine Dorn, that creepy voice. And you know, the good thing about that is Bernadine's voice reflects really how wicked and evil Marxism is, how destructive, how heartless, merciless. And she's enjoying that. She's still enjoying it, and so is her husband, Bill Ayers. And I hope you enjoyed that discussion, or at least learned from it. And, of course, they are the grandparents of today's radical movement in colleges and universities, and their writing and influence through these decades and modern universities have brought us to the place where we're at. And I've asked Bruce, my sweetheart Bruce, former FBI agent, former prosecutor in Chicago. We're both from Chicago, and Bernadine and Bill are pretty infamous there for us, aren't they, Bruce?
Very infamous. For years, they've dominated. I like your expression that you've used, as they are intellectual terrorists.
Yeah, they are.
They have gone from the streets. They're now in the universities and have been for years. And as you say, they're fomenting, as almost the grandparents of this movement, they're fomenting these kids.
You know, honey, the other connection with now is that they were both very well from very wealthy families. And so much of the Weather Underground and the SDS that they belonged to prior to that were wealthy. Kids from wealthy families.
Yeah, the hypocrisy is unbelievable, because what Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers preach is that the system holds people down. The system keeps them from getting getting what they deserve. Meanwhile, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, as you say, came from wealthy families. They use the system that they say is so horrible to go to school, to earn riches. And I don't see them turning back their riches or stepping down from their spots that they've gotten through using the system. All they do is use the system to aggravate people. You know, this whole idea of oppressor and oppressed, you know, if you think if that people love to put inflammatory terms on things that are really just part of nature. I think, a parent and a child, that is not an oppressor-oppressed relationship. But one person does have to be in charge, and one has to listen. Same thing with when you're at work. You have a supervisor and a worker. The supervisor is not an oppressor. The supervisor is there to get you to a place where the company is going, and you as a worker is there to provide a service. And they bastardize these terms, oppressor, oppressed, to stir up people.
To stir people up.
Anybody who feels that they've been wronged, instead of maybe looking in the mirror and saying, well, what am I doing wrong, or what can I do better,
No, you know what? It's somebody else's fault because I'm being oppressed by this person. It's their fault, not mine.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Bruce, because this a lot of communism operates on human psychology. And I think if you think of it this way, I'll make it real user-friendly. You are in a marriage, and not everything's perfect. And you tell your mother, and your mother sides with you, and she says, yes, he treats you. Oh, look how he treats you. He should never do that. He's using you. He's doing this. He's doing fill in the blanks. And you begin to think, oh, wow, I never... Wow, she's right. She's right. She's right. And then the anger builds and the resentment builds, and it can happen in relationships. That's human nature, as Bruce said. But that's what communists do artfully. And they first, you know, the Marxist, the first iteration, they would go into these peasant conclaves in Russia, villages, and they would whisper in the ears of the peasants how they were being oppressed by people who had more. I think it was the agrarians versus the owners of the farms or something like that. And so they built this resentment. They whispered, they stirred it up until the revolution began to gain steam. So that's what they're doing now.
Well, you know, we always say that really evil and really everything about life never changes. It just goes into different forms. And if you think about Marxism and stirring up people, go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. What happened there?
Yeah.
The serpent fomented trouble.
Yeah. Oh, did God indeed? Did he not, did he say that you couldn't eat from that tree? And first thing you know, Eve is resenting God, which was a complete twisting perversion of what God was actually doing, but she believed him and became resentful.
And you think about that, mm-hmm. because oftentimes I struggle with how much, say, in today's world, kids can turn against their parents after going to universities and being propagandized. But if our kids can be turned, just think if Eve could be turned against God, and think of how God treated and blessed them in the garden.
Yeah.
If that can happen, then it can happen with our children.
Yeah, it's just, it is human psychology, the worst side of us. And the Marxists are expert. I remember speaking of Marxists when Barack Obama, and yes, I do believe he's a Marxist, he was raised by Frank Marshall Davis. That was his mentor, who is a registered communist in the United States. His grandfather was a communist. His mother, I could go on and on. Yes, I do believe he is. He was mentored by Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. And maybe now you'll understand that a little bit better. So Obama comes along and he starts stoking resentment. I think even many people in the black community would agree that racism was far less before the black, so-called black president started stirring it up, and Eric Holder jumped in there right away. His first speech, that we are a nation of cowards over racism, and we were going, huh? What's he talking about? It wasn't in the news like it was now. We were not a perfect nation racially, but we'd come such a long way. There was a large black middle class, but boy, he stirred it up, and that's what he was doing because he's a Marxist, and he did it very well.
Yes, Barack Obama really fooled so many people. I personally know many people that voted for Obama because they thought, you know what, if we could elect a black president, that would go so far into healing
yes.
the divide
I know,
in this
people
nation.
People honestly wanted to do that.
And people really trusted Obama that he would do that. And in reality, he did the opposite. Now, he's very smooth. You know, he's not out there yelling like a Jesse Jackson, but it's more devastating in the way he handled it, in that he started, you know, just raising issues about, if you remember, the very first thing he did was return the bust of Winston Churchill because he said that the British were colonializers.
Yeah, so oppressor.
Oppressor.
Do we see a theme going on here? And a destruction of middle class, destroying farms, people's property rights, that's what he started doing. Even if he didn't say it, the hallmarks of communism were all over it. The anarchy in among sexuality. Remember the rainbow flag covering the White House when gay marriage was decided in the Supreme Court. These are the hallmarks. I just wanted to make that point. We could do that with a lot of different people in our country right now, but this is what's happening, and that is actually next-gen Marxism, which is what our book is about. So I just recommend it to you. It's got a lot more than we had a chance to touch on, but it's next-gen Marxism, what it is and how to combat it. I want to remind you that you can call us and leave a message at 662-821-2040. Thank you to so many of you who have done that. Love those messages. And even if we can't play them on the air, we will play some of them. We really do appreciate. They encourage us. And also feel free to call if you disagree or if you don't like something. That's what that's for. 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. And you can listen to the podcast at afr.net, our mothership, on any podcast platform or on my website, sandyrios.com. Honey, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, thank you so much for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.